intransigent obstacle to a conservative-dominated right-wing government, Strasser came to be seen as a more responsible and constructive politician who could bring Nazi mass support behind a conservative cabinet. Indeed, by this time, Strasser, increasingly influenced by the neoconservative ideas of Hans Zehrer's TAT group, was advocating notions of a broad front on the right. Now, as before, though there were variations of emphasis, Strasser's differences with Hitler were not primarily ideological. Strasser was an out-and-out racist. He did not shy away from violence. His social ideas were hardly less vague than Hitler's own. His economic ideas, eclectic and contradictory, were more utopian than, but still compatible with Hitler's cruder and more brutal notions. His foreign policy ambitions were no less extensive than Hitler's, and he was ruthless and single-minded in the drive for power. But tactically, there were fundamental differences. And after the 13th of August, as Hitler's political inflexibility threatened increasingly to block the road to power forever, these differences came more and more to the surface. Strasser, never a complete convert to the Führer myth, continued to take the view that the party which now showed plain signs of potential disintegration was not solely Hitler's creation. In contrast to Hitler's all-or-nothing stance, Strasser thought the NSDAP ought to be prepared to join coalitions, explore all possible alliances, and if necessary, enter government without the offer of the chancellorship. Immediately following the 13th of August setback, Strasser was exhorted by Reventlow and other supporters to stand out against Hitler. Otherwise, they argued, the party leader's hardline strategy would have catastrophic consequences for the movement. Through members of the TAT circle, Strasser had been introduced to General Schleicher in the summer of 1932. Schleicher was particularly interested in the possibility that Gregor Strasser could help bring the trade unions behind a national, that is, authoritarian government. This was something which the TAT circle had favoured. Unlike Hitler, whose dislike of trade unions had never wavered, Strasser was openly conciliatory towards the unions. Given his growing contacts with union leaders interested in a broad coalition to head off the dangers they saw on the far right and far left, the prospects of winning their support for a Schleicher cabinet that had Strasser in the government and offered an expansive work creation program could not be lightly dismissed. During the autumn, the rift between Hitler and Strasser widened. Already in September, Hitler distanced himself from Strasser's economic ideas by dissolving the political economy section, Wirtschaftspolitische Abteilung, which had been run by Otto Wagner, and banning further distribution of the economic emergency program, Wirtschaftliches Sofortprogramm, both of which Strasser had inspired. Then, in October, Hitler had refused to endorse a speech Strasser made to the NSBO, which contained pro-unionist sentiments. After the November election, Strasser lost his place in Hitler's inner circle. Privately, he was contemptuous of those he thought decisively influencing Hitler. Goering, he thought, a brutal egoist, Goebbels was from the bottom up devious, and Röhm simply a swine. Things looked black, he told Hans Frank. Goebbels, his old enemy since the inner party conflicts of the mid-20s in particular, had repeatedly castigated the Strasser clique, and had wasted no opportunity to poison Hitler against the organization leader. On the 31st of August, Goebbels had noted in his diary, "For the first time, Hitler speaks openly about the doings of the Strasser clique in the party. Here, too, he has kept his eyes open, and if he has said nothing, then that's not because he had seen nothing." 4 days later, he added, "I spoke for a long time with the Führer. He distrusts Strasser very strongly." Already in early September, Hitler had rejected out of hand Strasser's suggestion that the way forward would be to support a Schleicher cabinet. Around the same time, Strasser was the only Nazi leader advising against holding out for Hitler's appointment to the chancellorship. Goebbels wrote, towards the end of September, "It would be a blessing if he, Strasser, would carry out his secret sabotage work in the open, so that the Führer could act against him. Given the political sensitivities of the autumn, a public split in the party leadership was scarcely opportune. But by the first week of December, matters could rest no longer." At a meeting held in secret in Berlin on the 3rd of December, Schleicher offered Strasser the posts of vice-chancellor and minister-president in Prussia. The English journalist Sefton Delmer apparently passed on news to Hanfstengel that the two had met. Hitler gave no outward indication of his feelings when he heard of the meeting. That it had produced the offer of the vice-chancellorship to the second man in the party, who had not turned it down, only became clear to Hitler and other leading figures in the party, it seems, when they gathered for discussions in the Kaiserhof 2 days later. At this meeting, Hitler and Strasser became involved in heated exchanges. According to Goebbels, Strasser pleaded in vain for toleration of the Schleicher cabinet, but those present again approved of Hitler's flat rejection of any compromise whatsoever. Strasser's choices were now to back Hitler, to rebel against him in the hope of winning over some of the party, or to do what by the 8th of December he had made up his mind to do, resign his offices and withdraw from an active role in politics. After the meeting on the 5th of December, Strasser must have realized that the chances of leading a palace revolution against Hitler were minimal. His best support lay among the Nazi Reichstag members. But here, too, he controlled nothing amounting to a firmly organized faction. Pride, as well as his principled objections, prevented him from backing down and accepting Hitler's all-or-bust strategy. He was left, therefore, with only the third possibility. Perhaps disappointed at the lack of open support from his party friends, he withdrew to his room in Berlin's Hotel Excelsior and wrote out his letter resigning his party offices. On the morning of the 8th of December, he summoned those regional inspectors, Landesinspekteure of the party, the senior Gauleiter, who happened to be in Berlin, to his office in the Reichstag. Six were present, besides Reich Inspector Robert Ley. Goebbels, not surprisingly, was missing when Strasser addressed them. According to the post-war account of one of them, Heinrich Lohse, Strasser told them he had written the Führer a letter, resigning his party offices. He did not criticize Hitler's program, but rather his lack of any clear policy towards attaining power since the meeting with Hindenburg in August. Hitler was clear, he said, about one thing only. He wanted to become Reich Chancellor. But just wanting the post was not going to overcome the opposition he had encountered. And meanwhile, the party was under great strain and exposed to potential disintegration. Strasser said he was prepared to go along with either the legal or the illegal, that is, Putschist way to power. But what he was not prepared to do was simply wait for Hitler to be made Reich Chancellor and see the party fall apart before that happened. Hitler, in his view, should have accepted the vice-chancellorship in August and used that position as a bargaining counter to build up further power. On a personal note, Strasser expressed his pique at being excluded from top-level deliberations and had no wish to play second fiddle to Göring, Goebbels, Röhm, and others. Now, at the end of his tether, he was resigning his offices and leaving to recuperate. Strasser's letter was delivered to Hitler in the Kaiserhof at midday on the 8th of December. It amounted to a feeble justification of Strasser's position, couched in terms of wounded pride and not touching on the fundamentals that separated him from Hitler. It had the ring of defeat in the very way it was formulated. Hitler had been forewarned by Gauleiter Bernhard Rüst, who had attended the meeting called by Strasser, to expect the letter. He had immediately summoned the same group of party inspectors whom Strasser had addressed to the Kaiserhof for a meeting at noon. The group, in dejected mood, were left standing in Hitler's apartment, while, in an agitated state, he provided a point-by-point counter to Strasser's reasons for his resignation, as summarized by Robert Ley from the earlier meeting. Entering the Papen cabinet, he said, would have given the initiative to the party's enemies. He would soon have been forced, through fundamental disagreement with Papen's policies, into resignation. The effect on public opinion would have been the apparent demonstration of his incapacity for government, that which his enemies had always claimed. The electorate would have turned their backs on him. The movement would have collapsed. The illegal route was even more dangerous. It would simply have meant, the lessons of 1923 plainly recalled, standing the prime of the nation's manhood, das beste Mannestum der Nation, in front of the machine guns of the police and army. As for overlooking Strasser, Hitler disingenuously claimed he entered into discussions with whomsoever was necessary for a particular purpose, distributed tasks according to specific circumstances, and, according to availability, was open to all. He shifted the blame back on Gregor Strasser for avoiding him. His address went on for the best part of 2 hours. Towards the end, the well-worn tactic was deployed once more. He made a personal appeal to loyalty. According to Loza's account, he became quieter and more human, more friendly and appealing in his comments. He had found that comradely tone which those assembled knew and which completely convinced them. Now he was their friend, their comrade, their leader, who had visibly for each one again freed the way out of the completely muddled situation which Strasser had presented, convincing them emotionally and intellectually. As he spoke, Strasser sank with his dark prophecy ever more into a shadowy distance, although those present in consideration and under the impact of what he had said had come with considerable reservations. Increasingly persuasive to his audience and inexorably drawing them under his spell, he, Hitler, triumphed and proved to his wavering but upright and indispensable fighters in this toughest test of the movement that he was the master and Strasser the journeyman. So he had remained the outright victor also in this last and most serious attack, directed at the substance of the movement from within its own ranks. The old bond with him was again sealed by those present with a handshake. The mood that evening at Goebbels's house, where Hitler returned, was nevertheless still somber. There was real concern that the movement would fall apart. "If that were to happen," announced Hitler, "I'll finish things in 3 minutes." Dramatic gestures soon gave way to concerted moves to counter the possible ramifications of the treachery. Goebbels was summoned the same night at 2 a.m. to a meeting in the Kaiserhof, where he found Röhm and Himmler already with Hitler. Hitler, still stunned by Strasser's action, spent the time pacing the floor of his hotel room. The meeting lasted until dawn. The main outcome was the decision to dismantle the organizational framework that Strasser had erected, and which had given him his power base in the party. In time-honored fashion, as he had taken over the SA leadership, following the Stennis affair, Hitler himself now formally took over the leadership of the political organization with Robert Ley as his chief of staff. A new political central commission was set up under Rudolf Hess, and the 2 Reich inspectorates created by Strasser were abolished. A number of known Strasser supporters were removed from their posts, and a major campaign was begun, eliciting countless declarations of loyalty to Hitler from all parts of Germany, also from Strasser's sympathizers. Strasser was rapidly turned into the movement's arch-traitor. Hitler began the appeals to loyalty the very next day, the 9th of December, when he addressed the Gauleiter, regional inspectors, and Reichstag deputies. According to the report in the Völkischer Beobachter, every single person present felt the need to offer a personal show of loyalty by shaking hands with the Führer. "Strasser is isolated. Dead man," noted Goebbels triumphantly. Soon afterwards, Hitler set off on a speaking tour, addressing party members and functionaries at 7 meetings in 9 days. Again and again, the personal appeal was successful. No secession followed Strasser's resignation. The crisis was past. Following the shock announcement of his resignation, Gregor Strasser had immediately left for holiday in Italy. His resignation and departure sounded the death knell for Schleicher's political hopes. Belated discussions in early January between a dispirited Strasser and a chancellor whose star was evidently on the wane were a mere empty postscript to the December drama. On the 16th of January, following the revival of the party's fortunes, after a massive propaganda input the previous day in the state elections of the dwarf state, Lippe Detmold, Hitler delivered a 3-hour verbal assault on Strasser to his assembled Gauleiter at a meeting in Weimar. "His shares are no longer sought after. A short performance on the stage of significance, now he sinks again into the void from which he came," was Goebbels's stylistically embellished dismissal of Gregor Strasser in his diary entry. Strasser now retired fully from all political activity and from public view. He was not excluded from the party. In fact, early in 1934, he applied for and was granted the NSDAP's Badge of Honor, awarded to him as party member number 9, dating from the refoundation of the party on the 25th of February 1925. Neither this, nor a plaintive letter he wrote to Rudolf Hess on the 18th of June 1934, emphasizing his lengthy service and continuing loyalty to the party, could save his skin. Hitler was unforgiving to those he felt had betrayed him. His final reckoning with Gregor Strasser came on the 30th of June 1934, when the former second man in the party was murdered in what came to be known as the Night of the Long Knives. Had Gregor Strasser succeeded in splitting the party, bringing one part of it behind the Schleicher government, and joining the cabinet himself, the chances are that a Hitler takeover of power would never have occurred. History would have taken a different course. But in fact, Strasser never even seriously attempted to create a party rebellion. He turned his protest into a personal one by the nature of his resignation. As a consequence, it was all the easier to isolate him as Hitler and Goebbels orchestrated their recovery. And since his resignation and the way it was carried out fully undermined Schleicher's plans and left the Chancellor increasingly exposed, it paradoxically cleared the path which had appeared, also to Strasser, blocked to a Hitler chancellorship. Ultimately, the Strasser affair, the most serious of the inner party crises since 1925, revealed once again most graphically just how strong Hitler's hold over the party had become, how much the NSDAP had become a leader party. The implications of this for the character of the party on the eve of its becoming the state party of the Third Reich were illustrated in Hitler's guidelines for the organization of the party after Strasser's departure. Hitler's memorandum of the 15th of December 1932 on the inner reasons for the instructions to produce a heightened fighting power, Schlagkraft, of the movement demonstrates plainly the key differences between his conception of the party and that of Strasser. The basis of the political organization is loyalty. In it is revealed as the most noble expression of emotion, Gefühlsausdruck, the recognition of the necessity of obedience as the premise for the construction of every human community. Loyalty in obedience can never be replaced by formal technical measures and institutions of whatever sort. The aim of the political organization is the enabling of the widest possible dissemination of the knowledge seen as necessary for the maintenance of the life of the nation as well as the will that serves it. The final aim is thereby the mobilization, Erwassung, of the nation for this idea. The victory of the National Socialist idea is the goal of our struggle, the organization of our party, a means to attaining this goal. Such ethereal language emphasizes how remote Hitler's conception of the party was from any notion of a bureaucratic organization. Ideal, though in practice impossible, he went on, would be to do without organization altogether. As it was, organization should be kept to a minimum, since a worldview, Weltanschauung, needs for its dissemination not civil servants, but fanatical apostles. In preparing for the time when it would be able to permeate the state with this worldview, it was important to remember that the state, too, offered no end in itself, but was merely an institution that had to serve the maintenance and continuation of the life of a people. The supreme and most sublime mission of the party was, therefore, to provide for the expansion of the idea. To do this, it had continually to return to its greatest and first task, propaganda. Leaders were not to be imposed from above because of their administrative competence, but to emerge from below through their talents and achievements on behalf of the movement's struggle. There would be inevitable difficulties in working together between individual leaders of different temperament and ability, but this must be taken on board. The key issue was that the essentials of unconditional party discipline should not be affected by this. The party was engaged in the hardest ideological struggle. Hence, Hitler underlined once more, all its institutions have somehow to serve the propaganda of ideas. For Hitler, the organization of the party, his memorandum makes clear, had no meaning in itself. It was there solely to serve the ends of propaganda as a means to obtaining power. Propaganda and mobilization remained for Hitler the purpose of the party. Where Strasser had worked conventionally enough towards a bureaucratic structuring of the party, mirroring in essence the administrative framework of the state, Hitler intentionally destroyed any inherent bureaucratic rationality in favor of an instrument devoted solely to propaganda, to upholding the idea of National Socialism as embodied in the leader. The intrinsic contradiction between leadership of people, Menschenführung, and administration, Verwaltung, which would be laid bare during the Third Reich, was, his memorandum plainly shows, inherent to Hitler's conception of the party and approach to power. The untrammeled, personalized form of power that he represented could not dispense with bureaucratic organization, but was nevertheless inimical to it. As long as the party existed only to attain power, the contradiction could be sustained. In government, it was a recipe for chaos. 4. The mass of the German people had no part in, or knowledge of, the intrigues of high politics in the second half of 1932. They were by now largely powerless to affect the political dramas which would determine their future. As autumn turned to winter, they were entering upon the fourth year of deepening misery in the apparently unending depression. Statistics provide only an abstract glimmer of the human suffering. Industrial production had fallen by 42% since 1929. The stocks and shares index had dropped by more than two-thirds. In the hard-hit agrarian sector, which had felt crisis long before the general depression had caught hold, compulsory farm sales had more than doubled. Falling demand, prices, and income had brought about mounting indebtedness. Above all, the dark shadow of mass unemployment on an unprecedented scale hung over the country. The employment offices recorded 5,772,984 persons without work at the end of 1932. In January 1933, the figure was 6,013,612. Taking into account short-time workers and hidden unemployment, it was reckoned that the real total already in October 1932 had reached 8,754,000. This meant that close on half of the workforce was either fully or partially unemployed. Towns offered free meals at soup kitchens, cheap or free warm baths for the unemployed, and warming houses where they could shelter in winter. The politically radicalized among the unemployed had fed mainly the ranks of the KPD, par excellence the party of the young unemployed males, the overwhelming proportion of whose 320,000 to 360,000 members by late 1932 had no work. Not a few also found their way to the Nazi stormtroopers. Both the communists and the Nazis offered an organizational framework of support, forms of political activism, and the vision of a better society to the young unemployed. But alongside the unemployed who became radicalized, a great number were simply resigned and apathetic, imagining that all governments had failed and none was capable of mastering the problems which had brought about their fate. A few days before Hitler's appointment to the chancellorship, in conditions of freezing cold, the people of the small town of Ettlingen in Baden could not engender the slightest interest in an SA parade. There had been no shortage of demonstrations, they said, if only we had as much bread and work. Nor could a younger generation whose working lives had been entirely without work find much enthusiasm for a self-professed working-class party, the SPD, which had, however necessary it had objectively been, kept Brüning in office and voted Hindenburg back into power. Not a few would shrug their shoulders several years later and say that at least Hitler had brought them work, which the working-class parties before 1933 had failed to do. It was abbreviated logic, but it was how many felt. Mass unemployment split and atomized the working class, not just at the party political and ideological level, but at its social roots. For those still fortunate enough to have work, self-confidence was eaten away by fear of losing their jobs, by the loss of the power of the unions, exposure to employer aggressiveness, and, so far as they were sympathizers of the Social Democrats, by the SPD's perceived failure to look after working-class interests. The disorientation and disillusionment of so many former SPD supporters after 1933, however little they were won over by the Nazi regime, stemmed from what they saw as its unmitigated failure in the crisis of the state, of which it was the main pillar. In the countryside, too, there was a widespread feeling of hopelessness. Apathy sprang from the sense that there was no sign of improvement, whoever was in government. The mood of deep resignation had spread in areas of bedrock Nazi support in autumn 1932, after Hitler had turned down the chance of entering government, and the NSDAP's promises were no nearer to realization. From one district of Franconia, where the NSDAP had built up a high level of support, it was reported in the first days of January 1933 that the mood of the rural population is calm but extraordinarily depressed on account of the continued fall in prices of all agricultural products. A certain despondency has taken over. One gains the impression that many of those who had previously put their hopes in Hitler have become skeptical and have lost hope in any improvement. The sentiments, the report claimed, were general ones, not confined to that district. The disconsolate mood intermingled with enormous bitterness and political radicalization. From Lower Bavaria in January 1933, it was reported that all attacks on the government find a lively echo among the peasants. The more caustic the language, the more pleasant it sounds in their ears. The anger was further fired up by news that Eastern Aid, Osthilfe, intended for restoring agricultural prosperity on impoverished properties in eastern Germany, was lining the pockets of big landowners and being used for luxury expenditure. Bitterness towards all Weimar governments and parties, each of which was seen to have failed the people, was a hallmark of popular feeling in the countryside as it was in the towns. No one wants to know anything of a parliamentary government since all large parties had failed, was the reported mood in one Bavarian region in December 1932, a feeling certainly not confined to that part of the country. The Nazi Party was not excluded from such criticism. The party leaders are blamed for being led in their decisions less by considerations of people and fatherland than by those of the party and themselves. It is especially held against the NSDAP that it has recently shunned responsibility and does not follow its wide-ranging promises with action. No expectations were placed in Hitler in this region. Apart from National Socialists, the report went on, at this point reflecting the weighting of a heavily Catholic region, more or less all the remaining sections of society are negatively disposed towards a Hitler dictatorship. It concluded, under the impact of economic distress and the disunity of the other parties, the KPD is flourishing. At the same time, the despair was such that any political leader outside the ranks of the dreaded Marxists, who could bring about economic improvement, was guaranteed, at least in the short term, to attract support. This was to Hitler's advantage once he became Chancellor. The feeling that Hitler should at least be given the chance to see what he could do coexisted with initial skepticism. For other social groups, too, the expectations placed in Hitler's movement and the motivations that underpinned their subsequent support or antipathy were strongly influenced by experiences in the Depression years. The way society and government had fallen apart in those years brought to the boil the welling resentment at the democratic system and sense of national humiliation that had been simmering throughout the Weimar era. The depth of anger towards those held responsible was one side of the response. The desire for social harmony and unity to be imposed by the elimination of those seen to threaten it was the other and intrinsically related side. The report from one locality in Franconia in December 1932 brought out how sectionalized grievances combined to create generalized disaffection. Businessmen were complaining about poor turnover, ran the report, farmers about low produce prices, teachers and civil servants about their salaries, workers about unemployment, the unemployed about levels of support, and war cripples and war widows about drops in their pensions. All in all, there was general discontent, the best preparation, Wegbereiter, for communism. Middle-class disaffection was, naturally enough, fragmented along the lines of sectional interest. The outlook remained bleak. But despite some drop in confidence in Hitler in autumn 1932 from groups which had been a backbone of his support, no political alternatives were on offer on the right which appeared capable of creating the conditions of national renewal and imposed social harmony needed for economic recovery. For businessmen, craftsmen, and small-scale producers, the Nazis held out the prospect of salvation from the economic threat posed by department stores, consumer associations, mail-order firms, and mass production. Authoritarian rule was far from an unattractive proposition. Part of its illusion was an implied return to the good old days before the First World War and protection of the little man from the incursions of the modern interventionist state. Civil servants, smarting under Brüning's salary cuts, had their own illusions of a state which would restore their own traditional status and financial position. Teachers and lawyers also looked to renewed authority once the shackles of democratic interference had been removed, and to enhanced status. Doctors, too, like lawyers, a social group traditionally sympathetic to the nationalist right, had their resentment at diminished career prospects, falling earnings, and a leftist-imposed funding system greatly amplified during the Depression years. Many looked to a new authoritarian regime for rescue. For young people, the Depression years had both in material and in psychological terms been appallingly damaging. Hopes and ideals had been blighted almost before they could take shape. By the end of 1932, four consecutive cohorts of pupils had left school to miserable prospects. Those lucky enough to find work had done so in deteriorating conditions and were usually dismissed at the end of their apprenticeships. The youth welfare system was close to collapse. Growing suicide and youth criminality rates told their own tale. Those from more well-to-do backgrounds faced greatly diminished chances of launching a career in the professions to match their ambitions. Above-average support for the Nazis among university students was one indication of middle-class youth's alienation from the Weimar Republic. In fact, the attractiveness of extremist parties of right and left, the NSDAP and the KPD, to young people is an indication of their different forms of alienation from Weimar democracy and their readiness to resort to political radicalism. In many respects, it was a generational revolt against a system and a society that had failed them. Militant parties capable of playing to utopian expectations could fill the void produced by the alienation. Young Germans in late 1932 were still split largely along party political lines, which themselves reflected in the main class and religious divisions. The socialist, Catholic, and, taken together, the collectivity of bourgeois youth organizations still dwarfed the Hitler Youth. But the overlap of ideals and ideology with the bourgeois youth organizations, especially, offered a rich potential for expansion to the Nazi youth leader Baldur von Schirach, should his party start to recover from its setbacks of autumn 1932, and should his leader manage to get to power soon. The disaffection in German society did not, it seems, divide on gender lines. The Depression heightened the discrimination against women in the job market that had existed throughout the Weimar Republic. Traditional prejudice that a woman's role should be confined to children, kitchen, and church was strongly reinforced. The witch hunt against double earners, where both husband and wife worked and the woman was regarded as unnecessarily occupying a man's job, was an indication of growing intolerance. Nazi propaganda had no difficulty in playing on such intolerance both before and after 1933. But anti-feminism was by no means confined to Hitler's movement. Despite its macho image, the NSDAP's views on the role of women were essentially shared by all conservative and denominational parties. Women's political behavior in the Depression was little influenced by anti-feminism or, conversely, by pro-feminist issues. Women voted, it appears, much like men did, and presumably for the same reasons. They voted in disproportionately large numbers for the conservative and Christian parties, which were anti-feminist. They voted in smaller numbers than men for the radical parties of both left and right. The party with the most pronounced emancipatory stance regarding women, the KPD, was the least successful of all in attracting women's votes and was as male-dominated a party as was the NSDAP. Despite all the talk of Hitler's mesmerizing attraction for women, the elderly, statesmen like Hindenburg not the dynamic Nazi leader, had been their choice in the presidential elections earlier in 1932. But by the November Reichstag election, the gap between female and male voting support for the NSDAP had narrowed almost to vanishing point. Women were just about as likely as men to find the prospect of a Hitler dictatorship an attractive one. The mentalities which Nazism could build upon and exploit crossed the gender divide. Despite the disappointment in Hitler and decline in support for the NSDAP in the autumn of 1932, such mentalities, which would benefit the Nazi regime once Hitler had taken power, were kept alive and given sustenance by the bruising years of the Depression. Though two-thirds of the people had not voted for Hitler, many were less than root and branch opposed to all that Nazism stood for, and could fairly easily be brought in the coming months to find some things in the Third Reich that they might approve of. The loathing and deep fear of communism that ran through some four-fifths of society was one important common denominator. Faced with a stark choice between National Socialism and communism, which was how Hitler was increasingly able to portray it after his takeover of power, most middle-class and well-to-do Germans, and even a considerable leaven of the working class, preferred the Nazis. The communists were revolutionaries. They would take away private property, impose a class dictatorship, and rule in the interests of Moscow. The National Socialists were vulgar and distasteful, but they stood for German interests, they would uphold German values, and they would not take away private property. Crudely put, this reflected a widespread train of thought, not least in the middle classes. Fear, bitterness, and radicalization were part of a climate of political violence. These tensions of the Depression years had made political violence an everyday occurrence, even in the sleepiest of places. People became used to it. If it was targeted at the Reds, they often approved of it. Even respectable sections of society, which decried the breakdown of order in public life. Paradoxically, the party responsible for much of the mayhem, the NSDAP, could benefit by portraying itself, enhanced by the image of serried ranks of marching stormtroopers, as the only party capable of ending the violence by imposing order in the national interest. The acceptance of a level of outright violence in public life, which had been there at the birth and in the early years of the Weimar Republic, and again become pronounced in the Depression years, helped to pave the way for the readiness to accept Nazi terror in the aftermath of the seizure of power. Along with this went a vindictiveness that the deprivations and tensions of the Depression years had promoted. Someone had to be blamed for the misery. Scapegoats were needed. Enemies were targeted. Political enemies were lined up for scores to be settled. Personal and political enmities often went hand in hand. If the anonymity of the big city could offer some protection, that was not the case in small towns and in villages. Here, there was no hiding place. Once the power of the state could be used to support violence, not contain it, there would be no shortage of those volunteering to participate in the bloodletting. For countless others, the social and political conflicts of the Depression years stored up personal grudges that would be paid back after 1933 through denunciation for real or fictional political offences. As regards scapegoats, the Jews were an easy target. Nazi diabolization of Jews enabled them to be portrayed as both the representatives of rapacious big capital and of pernicious and brutal Bolshevism. Most Germans did not go along with such crude images, nor were they likely to become involved in or approve of physical violence directed at individual Jews and their property. But dislike of Jews extended far beyond Nazi sympathizers. No political party, pressure group, or trade union, and neither main Christian denomination made the defense of the Jewish minority an issue. And when times were hard, it was simple enough to stir envy and resentment against a tiny minority of the population. 0.76% in 1933 belonged to the Jewish faith, by stressing how they dominated out of all proportion to their numbers sections of business, the arts, and the professions. It was no coincidence, for instance, that one of the most viciously anti-Semitic Nazi sub-organizations was the Fighting League of the Commercial Middle Class, Kampfbund des Gewerblichen Mittelstandes, where small traders campaigned against department stores that they claimed to be largely in Jewish hands. Most people during the Depression years, as we have already commented, did not vote for the NSDAP or even join the party, primarily because of its anti-Semitism. But the widespread latent anti-Semitism in Weimar Germany, the feeling that Jews were somehow different, un-German, and a harmful influence, did not provide any deterrent to people offering their enthusiastic support to Hitler's movement in full cognizance of its hatred of Jews. And since that hatred was central to the ethos of a movement which was massively expanding its membership in the early 1930s, by the end of 1932 its membership numbers had reached 1,414,975, more and more people were becoming exposed, once in the movement, to the full brutality and viciousness of Nazi anti-Semitism. The same applied to the SA, by this time numbering about 400,000 stormtroopers. Even many of the young thugs who had been attracted to it in increasing numbers were not outrightly anti-Semitic before they joined. But once members, they were part of an organization whose fighting song contained the lines, "When Jews' blood spurts from the knife, good times are once more here." The 500,000-strong Jewish community, the vast majority patriotic, liberal-minded Germans, anxious to be assimilated into, not separated from, their fellow countrymen, was divided in its reactions to the upsurge of anti-Semitism. The main Jewish organization, the Zentralverein, the Central Association of German Citizens of Jewish Faith, took the danger very seriously and put up a sturdy defense of Nazi inroads into civil rights. Others were more complacent, a feeling they often combined with a sense of helplessness. They thought the danger would blow over. Few had direct experience of racist attacks, something Jews themselves associated with Russia, Poland, or Romania, not with Germany. It was possible to accept some discrimination, avoid threatening situations, and generally keep out of trouble. It was still possible to feel at home in Germany. It was still possible on the very last day of 1932, as Leon Feuchtwanger's fictional characters in Geschwister Oppermann did, to joke about whether the Führer would end up as a market salesman or an insurance agent. 3 years of crippling depression had left Germany a more intolerant society, a sign that the humane principles on which the Republic had been based were being whittled away during the Depression. As German society lurched towards the right, was the reintroduction of the death penalty in the early 1930s. A few years earlier, it had seemed close to abolition. The Nazis were to make it the pivot of their proclaimed restoration of order, another indicator of a changing climate in which liberal values were being rapidly eroded, was the radicalization of medical views on eugenics and racial hygiene. The costs of keeping mental patients in asylums at a time of drastic cuts in public expenditure brought increased pressure for legislation to introduce the voluntary sterilization of those with hereditary defects. Growing support for such measures among doctors, psychiatrists, lawyers, and civil servants led to draft proposals supported by the German Doctors' Association for a Reich sterilization law. Württemberg and Prussian chambers of doctors underlined their backing for such legislation in November and December 1932. Hitler's party, with a third of the voters behind it, went further and advocated compulsory sterilization of the hereditarily sick. In 1933, the Nazis wasted little time after coming to power in introducing notorious legislation to this effect. But the ground had been prepared by the experts before Hitler took office. At the end of 1932, images of Hitler continued to reflect, as they always had done, the main ideological divides and subcultures of German society. For the socialists and communist left, with only minor differences between them in this regard, Hitler was portrayed as the hireling of big capitalism, the front man for imperialists, the political strike force of the enemies of the working class. Such views were to persist after 1933 in the left-wing underground resistance organizations, the underestimation of Hitler they contained hindering clear perceptions of the ideological dynamism of Nazism. For Catholics, the other subculture which Nazism found greatest difficulty in penetrating before and after 1933, Hitler was above all seen as the head of a godless, anti-Christian movement. In Protestant church-going circles, impressions of Hitler varied. Some looked to the dangers of a neo-heathen movement which had roused the base instincts of the masses. Others saw the potential, at a time when church attendance was dwindling and moral and religious values were allegedly being undermined, of Hitler's national renewal, bringing in its wake ethical and religious revival. On the nationalist conservative right, the relatively sympathetic treatment of Hitler at the time of the Young Plan campaign had given way to hostility. Hitler was portrayed for the most part as intransigent and irresponsible, a wild and vulgar demagogue, not a statesman, an obstacle to political recovery, the head of an extremist movement with menacing socialistic tendencies. Against these negative images had to be set the adulation of the third of the population that, despite the setbacks of summer and autumn, still saw in Hitler the only hope for Germany's future. More than 13.5 million had voted for Hitler in the July election. They were all potential or real devotees of the Führer cult. Despite the losses in November, it still amounted to a huge reservoir of support, its focal point personalized in the extraordinary leader of the NSDAP. And if Hitler could once get to power and achieve some success, then there was the distinct chance that the strands of an ideological consensus rooted in strident anti-Marxism, hostility to party politics and pluralist democracy, and yearning for a restoration of national pride under authoritarian leadership, might come together to widen the basis of his support. The key would be whether he could shed the divisive image of a party leader and appear to stand above party for the nation. In January 1933, two-thirds of the German population was still dismissive of such a notion. 5. The events of January 1933 amounted to an extraordinary political drama. It was a drama that unfolded largely out of sight of the German people. A fortnight after Schleicher had taken over from him as Reich Chancellor, Franz von Papen had been guest of honour at a dinner at the Berlin Herrenklub. Among the 300 or so guests listening to his speech on the 16th of December, justifying his own record in government, criticizing the Schleicher cabinet, and indicating that he thought the NSDAP should be included in government, was the Cologne banker Baron Kurt von Schröder. A few weeks earlier, Schröder had been a signatory to the petition to Hindenburg to make Hitler chancellor. For months before that, he had been a Nazi sympathizer and was a member of the Kepler Circle, the group of economic advisers that Wilhelm Kepler, a one-time small businessman, had set up on Hitler's behalf. Already in November, though nothing came of it at the time, Kepler had told Schröder that Papen might be prepared to intercede with Hindenburg in favour of a Hitler chancellorship. Now, after Papen's Herrenklub speech, interested by what the former chancellor had had to say, Schröder met him for a few minutes late in the evening to discuss the political situation. The two had known each other for some time, and since Schröder also knew Hitler, he was the ideal intermediary at a time that relations between the Nazi leader and the former chancellor were still icy. Out of the discussion came the suggestion, probably from Schröder, though it is impossible to be sure, of a meeting between Hitler and Papen. Just before the end of December, Schröder rang Papen to ask whether he were free for a meeting during the next few days. The meeting was fixed to take place at Schröder's house in Cologne on the 4th of January, 1933. Since Papen was travelling to Berlin from his home in the Saar that day, intending to stop off at his mother's house in Düsseldorf, and since Hitler would be in the vicinity en route to begin the election campaign in Lippe-Detmold that evening, the venue was chosen because of its mutual convenience, though Kepler had in fact already suggested Schröder's house to Hitler as a meeting place following the banker's discussion with Papen on the 16th of December. In his own post-war account of the meeting, Schröder indicated that he had already taken soundings among figures from the business community about collaboration in government between Papen and Hitler, and found them favourably disposed. Fear of Bolshevism, the hope that National Socialism in power would provide a stable political climate for economic recovery, and removal of constraints on business autonomy were what they wanted. They hoped that a strong leader would come to power and form a government that would remain for a long time in office. Schröder's soundings had in fact extended no further than the Kepler circle, the limited number of businessmen whose sympathies for Hitler had not been in doubt. He had not consulted leading industrialists, either individually or through the main industrialists' organization, the Reichsverband der Deutschen Industrie, Reich Association of German Industry. The view, long taken for granted, that Schröder was acting as an agent of big business is without substance. Schröder did not know the leading figures in the business world, and they, for their part, had no idea of his attempts to bring Papen and Hitler together. Big business was in fact divided in its opinion of the Schleicher government. Its early fears of the Red General, regarded by business leaders as a crypto-socialist, had not materialized. Relations with National Socialism were, in the meantime, poor. For major figures in industry, Papen was still their man. His return to the Chancellor's seat, with Hitler in a subordinate role to bring the NSDAP behind the government, remained their favored scenario. As January progressed, it would prove to be the big landowners, through their lobbying organization, the Reichslandbund, Reich Agrarian League, rather than the captains of industry, who emerged as the mortal enemies of the Schleicher cabinet and the leading proponents of an elevation of Hitler to the chancellorship. Papen later disingenuously claimed that his aim was to try to persuade Hitler to join the Schleicher government. His actual aim was to take first soundings about the prospects of collaborating with Hitler in a new cabinet. Papen, whatever his later altruistic claims, was smarting from his ousting by Schleicher. Hitler knew that if anyone could unlock the door to Hindenburg's approval, it was Papen. Papen arrived around midday at Schröder's house. The meeting was meant to be secret, but word of it had leaked out. As he stepped out of his taxi, Papen was photographed. The following day, the Tägliche Rundschau, the Tat Circle's newspaper, reported that the meeting revolved around considerations of bringing about a Hitler government through using Papen's good offices with the Reich president. Papen and Hitler were both forced to deny that anything was discussed beyond the possibility of a great national political unity front. Papen found Hitler, who had entered through the back door, together with Hess, Himmler, and Kepler, waiting for him. Hitler, Papen, and Schröder adjourned to another room while the others waited. Schröder took no part in the discussions. Hitler began aggressively with an attack on Papen's treatment of him on the 13th of August and a denunciation of the sentences on the Potemper murderers. When he calmed down, talk revolved around the format for a new government. Hitler reportedly spoke of involvement of Papen's supporters in a cabinet under his leadership, as long as they were prepared to accept the removal of social democrats, communists, and Jews from leading positions and the restoration of order in public life. But for the first time in the course of the discussions, Hitler seems to have hinted that he might accept less than the chancellorship, at least for a while. A few days later, he told Goebbels that Papen was keen to bring Schleicher down and had the ear of the president. Arrangement with us prepared, either the chancellorship or power ministries, defense and interior, that's still to be heard about. Probably Papen had reminded him, if he needed reminding, that Hindenburg's objections to him becoming chancellor would still be difficult to overcome. Most likely the question of who was to lead the new government was left open at the meeting. Papen spoke loosely of some sort of duumvirate, and left open the possibility of ministerial posts, even if Hitler himself did not feel ready to take office for some of his colleagues. After about 2 hours, discussions ended for lunch with an agreement to deal with further issues at a subsequent meeting in Berlin or elsewhere. Papen evidently felt progress had been made. A few days later, reporting on the meeting to industrialists, he gave the impression that Hitler was prepared to play the role of a junior partner in a cabinet dominated by conservatives. In discussion with Chancellor Schleicher, on the 9th of January, Papen inferred that the Nazi leader would be satisfied with the defense and interior ministries. The implication was that the talks with Hitler had been about incorporating him in a Schleicher cabinet, not toppling it. And in a private audience with the Reich president the same day, Papen informed Hindenburg that Hitler had lessened his demands and would be prepared to take part in a coalition government with parties of the right. The unspoken assumption was that Papen would lead such a government. The Reich president told Papen to keep in touch with the Nazi leader. A second meeting between Hitler and Papen soon followed. It took place this time in the study of Ribbentrop's house in Dahlem, a plush residential suburb of Berlin, on the night of the 10th to the 11th of January. Nothing came of it, since Papen told Hitler that Hindenburg still opposed his appointment to the chancellorship. Hitler angrily broke off further talks until after the Lippe election. Elections in the mini-state of Lippe-Detmold, with its 173,000 inhabitants, would at other times scarcely have been a first priority for Hitler and his party. But now there were a chance to prove the NSDAP was again on the forward march after its losses the previous November and after the Strasser crisis. Despite the poor state of the party's finances, no effort was spared towards obtaining a good result in Lippe. For close on a fortnight before the election on the 15th of January, Lippe was saturated with Nazi propaganda. All the Nazi big guns were fired. Goering, Goebbels, Frick, and Prince Auwe spoke. Hitler himself gave 17 speeches in 11 days. It paid off. The NSDAP won almost 6,000 more votes compared with the November result and increased its share of the poll from 34.7 to 39.5%. The Nazis presumably won back most of the voters they had lost to the DNVP, whose support now dropped by over 3,000. The Communists also lost over 3,000 votes, while the SPD gained over 4,000. In reality, the Nazi success was less impressive than portrayed. Their support in the region still lagged by some 3,000 votes behind the result the party had obtained in the July Reichstag election. This was naturally overlooked. The optical impression was what counted. The bandwagon seemed to be rolling again. Hitler's possession was strengthened, however, less by the Lippe result than by Schleicher's increasing isolation. Not only had his lingering hopes of Gregor Strasser and gaining support from the Nazi ranks practically evaporated by mid-January, the Reichslandbund had by then declared open warfare on his government because of its unwillingness to impose high import levies on agricultural produce. Schleicher was powerless to do anything about such opposition, which had backing not only within the DNVP, but also within the NSDAP. Accommodation with the big agrarians would axiomatically have meant opposition both from both sides of industry, bosses and unions, together with consumers. Hugenberg's offers to bring the DNVP behind Schleicher, if he were to be given the combined ministries of economics and food, were therefore bound to fall on deaf ears. Correspondingly, by the 21st of January, the DNVP had also declared its outright opposition to the Chancellor. Shrill accusations, along with those of the agrarians, of the government's Bolshevism in the countryside because of its schemes to divide up bankrupt eastern states to make small holdings for the unemployed, were a reminder of the lobbying which had helped bring down Brüning. Schleicher's position was also weakened by the Osthilfe, Eastern Aid scandal which broke in mid-January. The agrarian lobby was incensed that the government had not hushed up the affair. Since some of Hindenburg's close friends and fellow landowners were implicated, the ire directed at Schleicher could be transmitted directly through the Reich president. And when, in the wake of the scandal, it was revealed that the president's own property at Neudeck, presented to him by German business 5 years earlier, had been registered in his son's name to avoid death duties, Schleicher was held responsible by Hindenburg for allowing his name to be dragged through the mud. At a cabinet meeting on the 16th of January, the day after the Lippe result had been announced, Schleicher had again raised the issue which had occupied Papen in the autumn, whether to seek a dissolution of the Reichstag and postponement of new elections, in other words, to risk a breach of the constitution. In contrast to Papen's last cabinet meeting, no minister opposed such a move. Schleicher remained optimistic that over a period of time he could broaden the support for his government and thought, following the line that Papen had fed him, that Hitler had now given up pretensions to the chancellorship and had the more modest aim of the defense ministry, which Hindenburg would certainly refuse him. Schleicher's strategy for a breach of the constitution was in effect no different from that which he himself had rejected, put forward by Papen. It required the support of the Reich president. At the beginning of December, Schleicher had persuaded Hindenburg that a breach of the Constitution and declaration of a state of emergency would risk a civil war, and that the Reichswehr would not be able to withstand the civil unrest.